Good afternoon. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I will ask the marshal to call the third case on our calendar today, set for 2:40.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradfold, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Diane B. Bradfold presiding. Now calling Abdullah Abdurizak Ahmed Gair versus Minnesota Department of Human Services. Case number A201015.
Welcome, counsel. We are proceeding this afternoon, as we have for some time, by Zoom today, and I know that you've had your connections checked and they seem to all be working. I trust that you'll let us know if there is something that goes awry and you've been given some instructions on how to do that. With respect to how we go ahead with our arguments, we follow the same procedures we always have. If you have any questions about that, let us know. In particular, I'll call your attention to two things. Before you start your remarks, please identify yourself as well as your client for the record. And we do that because this argument is recorded and the recording is maintained on our website as well as occasionally used by the court for its review of the case. And then secondly, please keep your eye on the clock. So it should be visible to you now and will indicate to you as your 15 minutes slowly goes down. We do look forward to the conversation. And with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Jason Steck, S-T-E-C-K. I represent the appellant Abdullah Gairy. This case is about who knew what and when. And I submit to the court that there are three points in time where who knew what or didn't know something requires reversal of the agency's decision to deny reconsideration to Mr. Gairy's disqualification. The first point in time that I would point to the court's attention is November 8th, 2016. This is the date that Mr. Gairy signed an agreement to settle three criminal cases, two of which he was involved with, one where he was charged personally and one where an agency, a business that he had an interest in, was charged. And in that agreement, Mr. Gairy agreed to a two-year disqualification from DHS. Now, it's important that the court look at index number 8 on this, is because this shows the close collaboration between DHS and the Hennepin County Attorney's Office in prosecuting the criminal case. No rational inference is possible from the record except that DHS knew about this two-year disqualification and indeed probably requested it. There's no reason that the Hennepin County Attorney's Office would have had any interest in a disqualification agreement on its own, or that anybody at Hennepin County would. Only DHS would care about a disqualification. So only DHS could have requested a two-year disqualification.
And the disqualification, Mr. Steck, was just from owning or working for childcare facility, right? For 2 years.
That's correct.
All right, so it wasn't the same area that the request for employment in 20 or the background study in 2020 was performed for. But also that agreement says that after that 2 years, that your client would be subject to all the normal and customary background checks before working, in childcare. I know you assert that DHS was in effect a party to that agreement, and if we agree with you, how is that violated by the department's conduct here?
Because it says after the disqualification period, he would be subject to the requirements of the Background Studies Act, which is, of course, everybody in the world is subject to the requirements of the Background Studies Act. But what the agency here is trying to use that is to say, well, we can make the two-year period into a 15-year period because the Background Studies Act requires a 15-year period. So essentially, it reads the two-year period completely out of the contract. But it also reads out the following the disqualification element of that. This is an advisory only. It's not a change or limitation or an expansion of the DHS's position on the contract. It's saying, look, you've got a two-year disqualification. After that, you're still going to have to be subject to the Background Studies Act, just like anybody else would be. It's not it doesn't function the way DHS is trying to say it functions here, as a license for them to ignore the 2 years that they agreed to and make it into a 15-year period.
Mr. Steck, you keep saying they agreed to it. Who are the parties to the disqualification agreement?
The state of Minnesota and MCCS, the business that Mr. Gehry was a part owner in.
Now, and what is it that we look to determine who the parties are to the disqualification agreement? Do we look at the signature lines? Is there some definition in the agreement itself of who the parties are to that agreement? What do we look to, and what does that, whatever it is you think we look to, what does that say about who the parties are to the who's bound by the disqualification agreement?
It's uncontested in this case that it is a part of a resolution to a criminal case. So the parties to that would be the parties to the criminal case, that being the state of Minnesota and the two different criminal cases at issue here, that being MCCS and Mr. Gehry.
You don't think there's any situation in which you could have a plea agreement, and part of that plea agreement, the defendant would agree not to do something without there being another party to that agreement?
Well, it's part of a plea agreement. So part of every plea agreement, there's two parties. There's the state and the defendant.
But in terms of who's making any promise, isn't it possible that as part of a plea agreement, someone can make a promise not to do something and there's no one else bound by that? Or are you saying that that's impossible? The only way that you can have some kind of separate side agreement is if both parties are considered bound by it?
I'm not sure I understand the court's question, but it sounds to me like the court might be asking whether or not the DHS wasn't a party to the agreement.
Well, let's just make a hypothetical. I know it's not exactly the facts of this case, but let's say, for example, someone pleads guilty to some kind of crime regarding using the internet. And as part of the guilty plea, they submit a document that says, I voluntarily agree not to use the internet for the next 2 years. Are you saying that both the state of Minnesota and that person are bound by that agreement when only one person is making a promise and only one person has signed it?
Well, I'd say that agreement, it does bind both parties. It binds the person not to use the internet for 2 years, but it also binds the state not to try and say, hey, it's been longer than 2 years, but you're still not allowed to use the internet. And that's kind of what's happening here, is that the state, Mr. Gehry, agreed to be disqualified for 2 years, but now the state is coming back and saying, we're still going to disqualify you for more than 2 years after the 2 year period that you agreed to.
And if I can be more specific, the language here is, I, Abdulrazak Ahmed Gehry, agree that the disqualification will last for 2 years.
Yes.
So who is making that agreement?
Mr. Gehry is making that agreement with the state to settle a criminal case. I think they're both making the agreement because it's part of the settlement in a criminal case. Well, and contracts are...
I'd like to follow up on that, because it seems to me the agreement that the state agreed to do was to dismiss the charges and not to pursue further civil or administrative actions against the entity and not to charge the individuals again. And then promises were made on the other side. I mean, the company promised to pay restitution and a fine, and the individuals promised to not, you know, to not work or own any childcare facilities for 2 years. So again, I'm also struggling with what agreement did the state arguably breach here?
Well, the state requested that as part of that plea agreement that Mr. Gehry agree to be disqualified for 2 years. Now, if Mr. Gehry could be disqualified anyway for 15 years, what's the point in even asking for such a document? It's an entirely superfluous and meaningless request.
Well, except that if there's an agreement, I'm not going to seek to own or work for a childcare facility, it will relieve then DHS of the burden of having to do a background study and decide by a preponderance of the evidence, whether your client did commit a disqualifying offense. So, I mean, it seems to me that is the impact of that agreement.
Well, and then that would get to the impact of the second important date here. And that's November 17th, 2017, when DHS issued its disqualification of Mr. Gehry. If it's as the court's suggesting here, that the... that Mr. Gehry, all he was volunteering for was to relieve DHS of any requirements to do anything for 2 years, then that's exactly the effect that is a problem on that second date, because that notice sent by DHS on November 17th, 2017 told Mr. Gehry, hey, you have a right to an appeal. It did not state the length of time of his disqualification. So it didn't advise him that, oh, if you don't appeal it, you're going to be disqualified for 15 years instead of two, like you thought. But relying on that and on the natural understanding of anybody in Mr. Gehry's position, he didn't appeal at that time. He didn't know that he was waiving his only right to appeal ever, the factual underpinnings of the disqualification. And he didn't know he was waiving his right to a contested hearing because he was acting in reliance on the understanding that he was only disqualified for 2 years. Nothing in the document that he received in November of 2017 gave him any reason to believe that he needed to bring that contested case, that appeal to the factual underpinnings, or he would be forever waiving a right to appeal a disqualification for 15 years.
Mr. Steck, let me ask it slightly differently. Are you saying that it would have been a breach of the agreement for Mr. Gehry to have appealed the 2017 decision?
I think it might have been interpreted as that, but more importantly, it was that it's about what he knew. Did he know that he had waived that right forever to a 15-year disqualification? And his right to that hearing can only be waived knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently. If he misunderstood, it was because he had been induced to misunderstand by the way that DHS pursued this 2-year disqualification and then a disqualification letter that didn't specify that it was for 15 years.
Well, but the 2017 letter did say that if you do not timely request reconsideration of the disqualification, subsequent background studies will result in an order for your immediate removal. I mean, isn't that enough of a notice to say, boy, I better appeal this because this doesn't make sense to me?
No, because it doesn't tell what the term of the disqualification is for. He reasonably believed, based on what he signed after the to resolve the criminal case, that he was only disqualified for 2 years. Why would he believe that he was going to be disqualified for 15 years based on the information made available to him at the time of the resolution of the criminal case and from the letter from DHS? It doesn't say you'll be disqualified for 15 years. It doesn't say, hey, that 2-year disqualification that you signed doesn't apply. It doesn't advise him on any of that. He's not being given full, complete, and accurate information that is necessary for a constitutionally valid waiver of his contested hearing rights. That's why it's a problem.
Are there any cases that excuse a party's failure to timely request reconsideration under Chapter 245C based on misunderstanding or something to that effect?
Well, I would submit that all the case law that resolves that arises from a unilateral mistake in a contract would support that. But there's also the Thompson case, which is referenced in our brief, that says that when a party has, for whatever reason, not received any opportunity to be heard at a contested case hearing, and their first opportunity to be heard is on a request for reconsideration, then that should be allowed. The fundamental nature of due process is the opportunity to be heard. Mr. Gehry never had an opportunity to be heard because he was denied the information that was necessary for him to make an intelligent decision in 2017. And after that, he never got an opportunity to be heard at all. The third date that is important is May 1st, 2020, and that's when DHS responded to Mr. Gehry's request for reconsideration. And what it's important to who knew what and when then, what's important is that DHS had reason to know that its preponderance determination was inaccurate or incomplete. But rather than evaluating any information, all DHS issued was a cursory, summary dismissal of his reconsideration request without any explanation whatsoever. DHS provided nothing but a form letter that they could print off by the batch load saying, we've considered your request for reconsideration and we don't agree with, and we're not going to change our decision. There's no indication that they even looked at the file let alone that they looked at any new information of any kind, or that they questioned their original opinion. All they did was summarily reiterate it. And what's important to look at here is the case that we cite in our brief of Williams versus Smith, that when an agency does this sort of cursory, out of hand dismissal of a request for reconsideration, it can be inferred that the agency did act arbitrarily and capriciously by rejecting that request for reconsideration, because there is nothing in the record to indicate that they actually reconsidered anything. All they did was print off a form letter. That's not reconsideration. That's quite frankly an act of blowing off the relator, not actually honoring their request for reconsideration. That failure to provide an explanation that is pervasive in these notices from DHS is itself denying the applicants and the licensees their ability to be heard. They don't know what they're trying to answer. They're simply being given a cursory, hey, we looked at whatever you said and we don't agree with it, so we're going to refer my original decision, go away. That isn't due process. In order to be heard, people need to be advised of what information the agency relied upon and why it rejected their request. It isn't too much trouble for them to provide an explanation. They didn't do that. And separate from the reasons above, that's the reason that this should be reversed and allowed to proceed back to at least a contested case hearing, if not specific performance. My time's expired. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we've reset the clock. So counsel for respondent, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is R.J. Dietrich. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the Department of Human Services. Now, the Department of Human Services Background Studies Act requires the Department of Human Services to disqualify an individual if it determines by preponderance of the evidence that the individual has committed an act meeting the definition of one of the offenses in Minnesota Statute Section 245C.15. Felony theft is one of those offenses and requires a 15-year disqualification. Here, the department appropriately disqualified Mr. Gehry based on a determination that he committed felony theft, a preponderance of the evidence determination that he committed an act meeting the definition of felony theft in connection with his ownership of MCCS, Child Care Center, and defrauding the Child Care Assistance Program in 2014 and 2015. Now,
Move forward, can you point me to where in the November 16th, 2017 letter does DHS advise the relator that his disqualification is going to be to exceed the 2-year period he had agreed to just 1 year earlier?
Your Honor, the letter does not admittedly specify the length of the disqualification. It does refer to the Background Studies Act, which specifies the length of disqualification, but the letter itself does not.
So why did it advise then Mr. Gehry effectively in a way that would prompt him to exercise his procedural due process rights? That this was just anything other than sort of a confirmation of the agreement he had entered into the prior year?
A couple of reasons, Your Honor. The disqualification agreement that he entered into the prior year, first of all, applied only to child care providers. The letter stated very clearly that the disqualification that it was referring to was not limited to child care providers. It included a number of licensed and unlicensed programs subject to a background studies study. And I believe it specifically mentioned personal care provider organizations like Wise Home Healthcare, the most recent position that he was disqualified for. So that clearly would have informed him that this disqualification was not the same as any disqualification based on that disqualification agreement. Also, you know, the letter doesn't reference the disqualification agreement at all. Instead, it says that the Department of Human Services disqualified him after reviewing records related to the 2014 and 2015 conduct, and determining based on those records by a preponderance of the evidence that he committed a disqualifying act, felony theft. So that clearly, you know, would have notified respondent that, or excuse me, relator, that this was not the same thing as the disqualification agreement, or dependent on the disqualification agreement in any way, or limited to that 2-year period.
Mr. Dietrich, would you agree that had Mr. Gehry, at the time of receiving the disqualification letter in November 2017, had he challenged that or asked for reconsideration, that that would be inconsistent with his agreement that he would be disqualified?
No, Your Honor, because as I've said, the disqualification that he was notified of in that letter was different from any disqualification that the disqualification agreement applied to.
It was broader than what he agreed to, in that it included something beyond childcare, but it wasn't limited to something outside of childcare. And so for him to contest the disqualification in November 2017, unless he's very clear that he's only contesting partially that disqualification letter, wouldn't the act of contesting be inconsistent with or a breach of an agreement to be disqualified?
Again, no, Your Honor, I don't believe so. I mean, you could contest that and say, I agreed to be disqualified for this, but not the rest of this. I don't see how that would be inconsistent. And that brings me back to the disqualification agreement itself. The disqualification agreement, as has been mentioned, only referred to child care providers and explicitly stated that after the 2-year period, relator would remain subject to the requirements of the Background Studies Act. Now, I would maybe understand Mr. Steck's argument if the Department of Human Services had said to a relator in 2017, we're disqualifying you, based on that agreement, had said in 2017 or after 2017, we're disqualifying you based on that disqualification agreement. Obviously, you know, you couldn't be disqualified based on that disqualification agreement outside that 2-year period. But that's not what the Department of Human Services did here. Department of Human Services reviewed records, as it's required to do for people in positions subject to a background study, reviewed records and determined, made a preponderance of the evidence determination based on those records that were later committed felony theft and therefore had to be disqualified. Like you indicated, the Department of Human Services then gave Relator an opportunity to challenge that disqualification, which presumably, you know, wouldn't happen if he had been disqualified based on something that he had agreed to. And I think the fact that the disqualification that we're now dealing with from Wise Home Healthcare makes it all the more clear that the disqualification agreement clearly doesn't apply to that, because that's a totally, even beyond the fact that the disqualification explicitly says it doesn't limit the ability of the Department of Human Services to disqualify him after 2 years. That's a completely different type of agency and not a child care provider.
Mr. Dietrich, given Mr. Geyer's agreement in 2016 to not seek employment or ownership of a licensed child care facility, what prompted DAH to do the background study? He hadn't applied for a job in that area or anything, had he?
The letter indicates that he was still, the record isn't entirely clear on that point. The letter indicates that he was still somehow affiliated with MCCS. And so that appears to be what prompted the background study, but admittedly the record isn't entirely clear on that point. And as far as the notice provided by that letter, in Jackson, a recent Supreme Court case, the Supreme Court indicated that in order to provide constitutionally sufficient notice, a letter in a disqualification matter like this needs to inform the individual of the action that the agency is taking, the process for challenging that action, and then the effect of failing to challenge that action. And that's exactly what the 2017 letter did here. It told later he was disqualified and why he was disqualified. It's explained that he could request reconsideration. And it explained that if he didn't request reconsideration, he'd be immediately removed from future positions because under Minnesota statute section 245C.29, his disqualification would be conclusive. And so that's why Relator, when he applied in 2020, although he was still able to request reconsideration and submit evidence to the agency, arguing that he shouldn't be disqualified, and was able to request a set aside, arguing that he didn't pose a risk of harm, which he didn't do, but he had the opportunity to do that. But nevertheless, he was not entitled to a fair hearing at that point. And that process has been approved by this court in Smith and by the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court in Jackson, as being constitutional.
Counsel, if you would address the argument made by Relator's counsel with respect to the 15-year disqualification and the failure, and I know we've touched on it briefly before, of the 2017 letter to mention the duration of the disqualification period. Can you direct me to any case law, as you have with Jackson, in terms of what is a sufficient notice, what are the basic types of information that must be in the letter? What about something specific, such as the period of disqualification?
Your Honor, yeah, I would just point you back to Jackson. And Jackson doesn't mention any requirement that the exact period of the disqualification needs to be listed in the letter. And I'm not aware of any case law that
but
does.
But Jackson didn't look at that issue, right?
I believe it didn't explicitly analyze that. Yes, okay. That's correct.
But so you're telling me we don't have any Minnesota case law that guides us on that point?
I'm not aware of any case law stating that it's a requirement for the time period of the disqualification to be listed in a letter. As far as respondents or Relator's argument that the disqualification here is arbitrary and capricious, Relator argues that DHS failed to consider the information he submitted with his request for reconsideration, and that somehow changes the outcome here. But that information, first of all, was only the disqualification agreement, which, as I've said, doesn't, affect the outcome or whether or not there was a properly or preponderance of the evidence determination that he committed felony theft. And then the only other document or evidence that was submitted with his request for reconsideration was a letter from the federal Department of Health and Human Services that said that that HHS, Federal Department of Health and Human Services, was not pursuing a debarment against Relator from participating in federally funded programs or something to that effect. But that letter specifically didn't mention the reason why HHS was not pursuing that debarment. I believe it referred to a separate memorandum that was attached that was not included with Relator's request for reconsideration. So neither of those documents provide any basis for DHS to reconsider its decision and change that preponderance of the evidence determination and disqualification. And
Mr. Dietrich, let me understand this. I think I understand your argument to be that by failing to seek reconsideration back in 2017, that the disqualification based on the felony theft conduct was conclusive at that point. Is that your argument? So, yes. I mean, of what import are the underlying facts and evidence to the question whether DHS, was operated within the law in giving the 2017 disqualification that conclusive effect?
Well, Relator still has an opportunity in 2020 when he was disqualified to submit evidence or to argue with the fact that he was correctly disqualified. So he still had the opportunity to put that in front of the agency. Again, it doesn't here indicate in any way that the agency's decision was arbitrary and capricious, but he had the opportunity to do that. The other reason that he argues that the agency's decision was arbitrary and capricious is because the agency didn't consider, I believe, trial transcripts that he referenced, or something that happened at the MCCS's trial that resulted in a mistrial that he appears to claim was exonerating, but that though no such transcripts are in the record. And again, Relator had the opportunity with his request for reconsideration to submit that information if it exists, and he didn't do so. So he can't claim now that DHS acted arbitrarily and capriciously by not considering something that was never put in front of it and that may not exist. With that, Your Honors, if there are no more questions, I would just ask that the court affirm the Department of Human Services decision.
Thank you, counsel. All right, Mr. Steck, I think we have 5 minutes on the clock, and so we'll turn to you for your rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. DHS's argument here about the November 16, 2017 letter really requires that Mr. Gehry draw a lot of inferences out of that letter that are not apparent on its face. Mr. Gehry is a Somali. He's not a native English speaker. Yet based on his ability to read into this letter, all these advisories that DHS is now pulling out of as implied, his failure to be able to do that has now caused him to not be able to make a living. That's not procedural due process. That advisory needs to be specific enough that a person of ordinary intelligence can understand exactly what they're giving up by not appealing. And I'd submit that failure to specify a time period is a crucial and indeed fatal failure in this case. Now, the court asked some questions about the...
What do you mean the time period? You mean the fact that the disqualification was for 15 years?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a case that requires a notice such as this to contain that precise information?
I mean, I labored at some length in my reply brief to distinguish the Jackson case, but ultimately you don't need to, because that would be the authority. One of the things that the advisory has to contain under Jackson is a description of the action the agency is taking. I'd submit that, particularly under these facts, but really in any case, the length of the disqualification period is a critical part of that action. And the person needs to be advised of exactly how long they're being disqualified for so they can make an intelligent decision about whether to go forward with the effort of asking for a contested case. That failure to provide an advisory as to the time period means that the description of the action that the agency is taking is inadequate on its face for anybody. But particularly in this case, where Mr. Gehry has a reason to believe that he's only disqualified for 2 years. That's crucial information in any case, but particularly here. Now, the court also asked Mr. Dietrich about whether or not had Mr. Gehry taken advantage of his appeal rights, whether he could have been found in breach. And Mr. Dietrich assures us that he couldn't have been. Well, that's easy to say now, but look at it from Mr. Gehry's point of view in 2017. He understands that he's agreed to be disqualified for 2 years. And if he goes back and then says, I'm challenging my disqualification, does he think, is somebody in his position, can they be reasonably certain that they won't be at least accused of having violated their plea agreement? He has to deal with that risk. It's easy to say in hindsight that no, that never would have happened, but I don't think a person in that situation can have that assurance. He thought that he couldn't, that he had agreed to it. And as a result, he chose not to challenge it at that time.
Well, his agreement was not to seek employment. And I think the disqualification, I mean, if he would have challenged that, he wouldn't have had to be seeking employment. He could have just said, I shouldn't be disqualified as per your letter because my only agreement was not to seek employment and I haven't.
That's not, with respect, Your Honor, that's not what the agreement says. The plea agreement that the agreement that he signed says that he agreed to be disqualified. It doesn't say that he would agree not to seek employment.
It says, I agree to be disqualified from working, owning, or otherwise being involved in a child care center or child care provider that is required to be licensed.
Okay. Then it says both. I mean, it uses the word disqualified. And I think in somebody in Mr. Gary's position, when they're saying receiving a letter saying you've been disqualified and here's the way you appeal, they're going to say, I already agreed to this. Why would they appeal? And especially why would they appeal if it's possible that that appeal itself might be interpreted as a violation of their plea agreement. Now, the last thing I'd like to note is that Mr. Dietrich frequently discusses the fact that Mr. Gary could always present information in a request for reconsideration. That potential is purely illusory, whereas here, the department simply blows it off. Any information that they're given, there's no indication that they even read it, because all they do is send out a form letter that says, we received your request for reconsideration, we've decided to affirm our opinion, and provides no explanation or reference in any of any kind to the specific information that they were provided with. Mr. Dietrich's averment that right now it's obvious that it's not sufficient information doesn't matter. There was no explanation provided, so there's no indication that DHS ever looked at his information at all.
You were anticipating me, Mr. Stack. Thank you. So your time's expired, but we very much appreciate the arguments, Mr. Stack, Mr. Dietrich, that you presented to the court today. The matter has been well briefed and well argued, and we very much appreciate that. So with that, the case is submitted to us for our decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe.